the second, grandson of Lorenzo the Magnificent, but there is a strong possibility that he was in fact the bastard son of Pope Clement himself. This second marriage was less successful. After only a year, Alessandro was assassinated by his distant cousin, Lorenzino. His magnificently arrogant portrait by Sebastiano del Piombo, now in Naples, survives him. At least Clement was spared the shame of his final defeat. It was only 2 months after his death that the English Parliament approved the Act of Supremacy, which declared the king to be the only supreme head on earth of the Church of England, and shook off for ever its subjection to Rome. The preposition was important. Heretofore it had been the Church in England. The of made all the difference. Henry even went so far as to proclaim himself a Moses, delivering his chosen people from the bondage to which they had been condemned by the papacy. Such a presumption was unprecedented. Never before in Europe had a secular prince assumed such full spiritual authority over his subjects. The difficulty was to apprise those subjects of the fact. Decrees were promulgated the length and breadth of the kingdom. All those in authority were required to swear oaths, recognizing Henry as supreme head of the church and specifically renouncing Rome. The Pope's name was to be erased wherever it appeared in the liturgy. In the parish churches, sermons were to be preached every 3 months, explaining what had occurred and congratulating the congregations on their escape from their former bondage. All this was supported by an endless succession of books and pamphlets, pageants and plays. Now, for the first time in England, the printing press showed what it could do. The news of Pope Clement's death was, it need hardly be said, enthusiastically welcomed by Henry. To Francis, however, it came as a crippling blow. The new entente for which he had worked so hard was now in ruins. The magnificent marriage of which he had been so proud was henceforth a mésalliance. The Medici, for all their magnificence, had always been considered a fundamentally bourgeois family, and always would be. Had Clement been succeeded by another member of his clan, all would have been well. But the election of Alessandro Farnese, whom on the 13th of October was elected as Pope Paul III, meant a complete reappraisal of French policy towards the Holy See. And, as if that was not enough, only 5 days later came l'affaire des placards. Article véritable sur les horribles, grandes et importables abus de la messe papale. Such were the opening words in large Gothic type of the placard, or broadsheets that appeared all over Paris on the morning of Sunday, the 18th of October, 1534. The four long paragraphs following were purely theological in character and need not concern us. Suffice it to say that they formed a violent attack on the Catholic Mass, expressed in a language that terrified their readers. The city was swept by a wave of hysteria as the rumours spread. All Catholic churches were to be burned to the ground. All the Catholic faithful were to be massacred in their places of worship. The panic increased further when it was learned that the placard had not been confined to Paris. They had also been found in Orléans, Tours, Blois, and Rouen, and one, it was said, had even been discovered fixed to the door of the king's bedchamber at Amboise, where he was at that time in residence. The search for those responsible began at once. Countless arrests were made, several innocent unfortunates were burned at the stake, and sadly Francis himself seemed to lose his head. What followed was nothing less than an inquisition. All new books were banned, in order, presumably, to defy the terrorists, for it was as such that they were seen. A general procession was summoned for the 21st of January in Paris. The most sacred relics, they included the crown of thorns from the Sainte-Chapelle, were removed from the city's churches and paraded through the streets, from Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois to Notre-Dame, the Blessed Sacrament being carried by the Bishop of Paris beneath a canopy borne by the king's three sons and the Duc de Vendôme. Immediately behind it walked Francis himself, dressed entirely in black, bareheaded and carrying a lighted torch. On arrival at the cathedral, High Mass was celebrated, after which he and Queen Eleanor were entertained to lunch at the bishop's palace. The king then addressed a large crowd, encouraging his subjects to denounce all heretics, even families and friends. The day ended with another six burnings. And so the reign of terror continued. Why, one wonders, was there so wild an overreaction to what had been, in fact, fairly slight provocation? The answer usually given is that Francis took the placard found at Amboise as a personal affront, but this is not easy to believe. Less than 2 years earlier, in January 1533, three armed strangers had been found in Francis's chamber in the Louvre. His only reaction had been to ask the Parlement to show more vigilance at night. The truth, surely, is that he had no choice. The provocation was indeed slight, but it did not seem so at the time. The placard, couched as they were in violent and abusive language, attacked the church, the mass, the priesthood, and, through them, every one of the king's God-fearing Catholic subjects. As the most Christian king, Francis could not have ignored them or even passed them over lightly. He may not have instigated the resulting persecutions, which were more probably ordered by the Parlement, but he could not possibly have withheld his approval. What is undeniable is that after the Affaire des Placards, France was never the same again. Between 1541 and 1544, six Parisian booksellers or printers were prosecuted, one was tortured, and two were sent to the stake, and in 1542 the Sorbonne began to compile the first index of forbidden books. Henceforth, Protestantism was to be considered a dangerous threat. French Catholics felt themselves to be under siege, and the wars of religion began to cast their shadow. When Henry and Francis had separated in October 1532 and had expressed their intention of joining forces against the Turk, the words, "one of these days," were almost audible. The two kings were speaking of a vague intent rather than of any specific plan, and this was perfectly easy to understand. The Ottoman Empire was a long way away, and, to Henry at least, of little direct concern. For Charles V, on the other hand, who had seen the Sultan at the gates of Vienna only 3 years before, it was a very real danger. Out of sheer necessity, he kept a close eye on his Turkish neighbour, and suddenly, in 1534, the alarm bells rang. This new danger was not, as might have been expected, in Eastern Europe. It was in the southernmost corner of his empire, the island of Sicily, and it was represented not by the Sultan personally, but by the most dangerous of his subjects, the pirates of the Barbary coast. The expulsion of the Moors from Spain in the year following 1492 had led to a proliferation of rootless vagabonds, ruined, homeless, disaffected, and longing for revenge, and many of them had joined their co-religionists in North Africa and adopted the life of buccaneers. Between Tangier and Tunis there were some 1,200 miles, and in what was for the most part still a moderately fertile and well-watered coastal strip, innumerable, almost tideless natural harbours ideal for their purposes. And so the legend of the Barbary coast was born. In the early 1530s, the leader of these corsairs was a certain Kheireddin Barbarossa. Born on the island of Mytilene, now Lesbos, he was the son of a retired Greek-born Janissary, and his wife, who was the widow of a Greek priest. Since the Janissaries were all forcibly converted Christians, Kheireddin possessed not one drop of Turkish blood. He had inherited the leadership from his brother Aruj, known in Turkish as Oruç, who had wrought havoc along the coast among both Christian and Muslim shipping, and who, in 1516, had strangled the Sultan of Algiers with his own turban. In the following year, he had conquered much of what is now Algeria from Spain, and had presented it to Suleiman's father, Selim I. In consequence, the whole territory was now an integral part of the Ottoman Empire. Aruj had been killed during the Spanish siege of Tlemcen in 1518. But before the end of the year, his brother had recognized the Sultan as his suzerain, and the subsequent exploits of Kheireddin Barbarossa along the coast over the next 15 years had so impressed Suleiman that in 1533 he had appointed him Kapudan Pasha, chief admiral of the Ottoman navy. And so it was that in the early summer of 1534, Barbarossa sailed with a newly built fleet out of the Golden Horn with the ultimate aim of an important new conquest, Tunisia, under its ruler Muley Hassan, who was said to have murdered his 44 brothers in order to obtain the throne, and then to have filled his harem with 400 young boys of unusually exquisite appearance. Barbarossa began, characteristically, by ravaging the coastal cities and towns of Calabria. One night, so the story goes, he landed secretly at Fondi with the object of kidnapping Giulia di Gonzaga, the wife of a certain Vespasiano Colonna, and one of the famous beauties of her day, in order to present her to the Sultan for his harem. He is said to have been put up to this escapade by Ibrahim Pasha, who hoped that the lady might supplant Roxolana and Suleiman's affections. She, however, clad only in her nightdress, managed to escape on a horse, accompanied by a single knight whom, either because he had shown over-familiarity, or because he had perhaps seen too much of her person, she subsequently ordered to be killed. The capture of Tunis was not a difficult operation. Barbarossa arrived outside the harbour on the 16th of August, and immediately began a bombardment, only to find that Muley Hassan had already fled. All that winter he kept his men busy, reinforcing the harbour defences and building an impressive new fortress, big enough to accommodate a garrison 500 strong. But he need not have bothered. This time he had overreached himself, having seriously underestimated the probable reaction of Charles V and his power to retaliate. A glance at the map will show that the two most prosperous ports in the extreme west of Sicily, Trapani and Marsala, are less than 150 miles from the Tunisian coast, and Palermo itself only very little more. The idle and pleasure-loving Muley Hassan had constituted no appreciable danger, but now that Barbarossa was supreme in Tunis, the emperor's own hold on Sicily was seriously threatened. As soon as he heard the news, Charles, mindful of his grandmother Isabella's dictum that the Reconquista would be complete only after the western Mediterranean had become a Spanish lake, started to plan an immense expedition to recover Tunis. If, he reasoned, he did not act decisively and at once, there was a very real possibility that the whole coast would fall to the Turks. There would then be a serious threat to Sicily, and indeed to Spain itself. The invasion fleet that he collected would finally include ships from Spain, Naples, Sicily, Sardinia, Genoa, and the Knights of St. John on Malta. In effective command would be the celebrated Genoese Andrea Doria, a condottieri admiral, he might be described as a sailor of fortune, who had abandoned the French after a serious quarrel with King Francis only 6 years before. He had then transferred his allegiance to the emperor, bringing Genoa with him and thus putting into Charles's hands an important naval base, which would vastly facilitate his frequent journeys between Italy and Spain. But Charles himself, despite being tortured by gout, was determined to sail with the Spanish contingent in what was to be his first serious taste of naval battle. The imperial fleet, estimated at over 400 ships and carrying an army of some 27,000, sailed from Barcelona at the end of May 1535 to the agreed rendezvous at Cagliari in Sardinia, where it arrived on the 10th of June to be joined by another 200 vessels of varying kinds. Then, on the 13th, it turned south, and on the following day hove to in the roadstead outside Tunis. Against such an armada, Barbarossa, with only some 60 ships and a few thousand Turks, Arabs and Berbers, saw at once that there was little hope of retaining his hold on the city. Having no intention of losing more ships than necessary, he had already taken the precaution of sending 15 of his best along the coast to Bonn, about halfway to Algiers, where they could be kept safely in reserve. He and his men fought valiantly, as they always did through the African summer heat. But on the 14th of July, exactly a month after Charles's arrival, the fortress of La Goleta, which defended the inner harbour, was stormed by the Knights of St. John, and a week later the many Christian captives who were being held in the city, the chroniclers say 12,000, but this seems unlikely, smashed their way to freedom and flung themselves on their erstwhile captors. La Goleta is now La Goulette. The knights took possession of several cannon, which greatly to their surprise turned out to be French, having the fleur-de-lis clearly engraved on their barrels. Now it was Barbarossa's turn to flee. In company with his two fellow captains and as many more of his men as were able to follow him, he slipped out of the city and made for Bonn. At this point Charles should have ordered his army to leave at once in pursuit and engage the old corsair in a pitched battle. Had he done so, he might have destroyed Kheir ed-Din Barbarossa forever. The imperial fleet should have had no difficulty in preventing his escape by sea. But the soldiers, and probably the sailors too, were far too busy raping and plundering, as for 3 days and nights the rules of war allowed. Muley Hassan, having agreed to pay the emperor an annual tribute, was then formally reinstated in the empty shell of his city, while the Spaniards, having repaired and refortified La Goleta, declared it Spanish territory and equipped it with a permanent garrison. The expedition, the victorious Christians all agreed, had been a huge success. Tunis was once again in friendly hands. Sicily was secure. Hundreds, if not thousands, of their co-religionists had been freed from captivity, and, best of all perhaps, the previously invincible Barbarossa had been conclusively defeated. The emperor had also clearly demonstrated that it was he, rather than the infidel-loving French, who was the true defender of Europe. Now he and his allies could all return to their various homelands, well satisfied with what they had achieved. Or so they thought. Some days afterwards, the emperor actually did send Andrea Doria on an expedition westward along the coast to find the fugitive corsair and bring him to book. But he was far too late, and anyway, he did not know his man. It was typical of Barbarossa that, instead of slinking back to Algiers as they had assumed he would, he had put in at Bonn only to collect more ships and supplies before immediately heading north to the Balearic Islands. As his squadron approached, the islanders understandably assumed it to be part of the emperor's fleet returning to Barcelona, an impression confirmed when the ships were seen to be flying the imperial colours. There was no resistance, therefore, when they glided soundlessly into the harbour of Mahon in the southeast corner of Menorca. A Portuguese merchantman, lying there at anchor, greeted them with a friendly salute. Then, suddenly, the squadron opened fire. The Portuguese, taken by surprise, defended themselves as best they could, but their vessel was easily captured. It was only a matter of hours before the whole port, and indeed the whole city, was sacked and destroyed. On his return from Tunis, Charles had landed at Trapani in Sicily. He had then made his way first to Palermo, and then along the coast to Messina, and was now travelling up through southern Italy on his way to visit the Pope in Rome. The recently elected Pope Paul III was so impressed by the emperor's capture of a key North African port that he unwisely sent his reprobate son, Pierre Luigi, although a cardinal at 25, Paul had since cheerfully fathered four sons, to meet him in Naples. Pierre Luigi's instructions were made painfully clear. First, he was to show his Imperial Majesty every courtesy and make the most favourable impression possible. Next, he was to do his best to discover his future intentions. And finally, his father emphasized, he must abstain so far as possible from sodomy while at the imperial court. The young man doubtless did his best on all three counts, but his mission was not a success. The emperor seems to have taken an instant dislike to him, and he was almost immediately sent back to Rome. The day before Charles landed in Calabria, on the 1st of November, 1535, the Lord of Milan, Francesco Sforza, had died, leaving no male heir. For King Francis this was an opportunity and a challenge. The possession of Milan had been the keystone of his foreign policy since his accession. Was the Duchess Valentina Visconti not his great-grandmother? Twice already, in Madrid in 1526 and again in 1529 at Cambrai, he had been obliged to renounce all rights to the duchy. But now, unhesitatingly, he reasserted his claim, proposing that it be bestowed on his second son, Henry, Duke of Orléans. For Charles, however, who, as suzerain of Milan, had its investiture as his gift, but who, 20 years later, was to confess to his son that Milan had tormented him more than all the rest put together, and longed to shake off this most intractable problem once and for all, the proposal was out of the question. Henry was too close to the throne. As the husband of Catherine de' Medici, he had a claim to the Duchy of Urbino. If he were Duke of Milan, he would need only Naples to become effectively master of Italy. The emperor agreed, however, to consider the investiture of Francis's third son, the Duke of Angoulême. This was the position when, in the first weeks of 1536, it was reported to Charles that a French army had suddenly invaded the Duchy of Savoy and taken Turin. There was a quarrel of long standing between Francis and his uncle, Duke Charles III, whom he believed to be clinging on to territories that properly belonged to his mother, Louise, and the outbreak of an insignificant little war between the duchy and the Grand Council of Geneva seemed to him the perfect opportunity to step in and settle matters once and for all. Geneva was to proclaim itself a Protestant republic in May of that year. Overwhelmingly outnumbered, Savoy offered little resistance. Chambéry, Then its capital fell on the 29th of February, 1536 was a leap year, to be followed by Turin a week or two later. Francis claimed, as might have been expected, that his attack was an act of self-defence, since he was only trying to recover territories that were lawfully his. But this was transparently disingenuous. What he was really doing was providing himself with a quid pro quo in any future negotiations with the Emperor over the future of Milan, Turin being less than 100 miles away. Besides, if these negotiations were to fail, he would now have the perfect springboard from which to invade the duchy. In any case, it was clear that Milan was now once again under serious threat. Charles was outraged. He must surely have discussed the matter with the Pope the moment he reached Rome, but on Easter Monday, 17th of April 1536, to underline the gravity of the situation, he made a formal set speech to Paul in Spanish. His Italian was obviously inadequate to the occasion, on the subject of his relations with France. He had, he declared, devoted many years to attempt to win the goodwill of King Francis and to gain his agreement to march with him against the infidel, but all his efforts had been in vain. He now publicly offered Francis a choice of three possibilities. The first was peace, in return for which he was prepared to cede Milan to the Duke of Angoulême. The second was war, a war that might so weaken Christendom as practically to invite the Sultan to help himself to Western Europe. The third was the most surprising of all, single combat between king and emperor, the prize being Burgundy on the one side and Milan on the other, after which the victor would lead their combined forces against Constantinople. Would the Pope support him, or would he not? During this harangue, Charles, unusually for him, seems to have become overexcited and perhaps somewhat hectoring. It is recorded, at any rate, that at a given moment the Pope could not take it any more. Rising from his chair, he laid a hand on the Emperor's shoulder, murmuring, "Enough, my son." No one took the idea of single combat very seriously, and in the circumstances, peace was out of the question. The result was that Charles and Francis were once again at war, a war that, in the summer of 1536, brought the Emperor his first significant defeat. His plan, originally suggested by Andrea Doria, had been for a joint land and sea operation in Provence. He occupied Aix without difficulty and reached the gates of Marseille. But the scorched-earth tactics of Anne, that was indeed his name, de Montmorency, Grand Marshal of France, proved too much for him. Marseille was found to be impregnable, and an outbreak of dysentery in the army did the rest. He had no course but to order a retreat to Genoa. By November, he was back in Spain, licking his wounds. 5. Like a brother to the Sultan. It is interesting to speculate, as the Emperor Charles did battle off the North African coast with the navy of Suleiman the Magnificent, how much he knew of the Sultan's diplomatic activities, and particularly of his recent dealings with Francis. For the past decade, to the alarm and frequently the disgust of Christian Europe, King and Sultan had been in friendly contact. It was not altogether surprising. Here, for Francis, was an invaluable ally prepared to fight his battles with the Emperor. For Suleiman, there was an unrivalled chance of splitting the forces of Christendom more drastically than ever, and even, to some degree at any rate, acquiring a Christian ally. For this purpose, he offered Francis the services of the most powerful of his subjects, Kheir ed-Din Barbarossa, who, from France in 1533, actually sent the king a number of French prisoners still in chains, so that he could have the huge pleasure of releasing them himself, and a quantity of magnificent presents, including a lion. This was shortly followed in 1534 by an embassy from Istanbul, requesting Francis on no account to make peace with the emperor, because the Sultan intended to force him to return everything that he had taken during the king's imprisonment. "The King of France is on terms of peace and concord with us," announced the Grand Vizier Ibrahim Pasha. "He is like a brother to the Sultan." By 1535, however, fraternity was no longer enough. Francis needed Suleiman's active assistance against Charles. In February, he dispatched to Istanbul one of his most trusted diplomatists, Jean de La Forette, a knight of St. John who spoke both Italian and Greek, and carried with him detailed plans for a full-scale military campaign. The ambassador stopped first in Tunis to see Barbarossa, this was still several weeks before the emperor's expedition against the city, to plan the year's campaigning. The general idea was that the corsair, with French assistance, would make a surprise attack on Genoa. Meanwhile, the main body of the French force would launch a campaign in Italy, while the Sultan would open another, by land and sea, against the Kingdom of Naples, which was at that time under a Spanish viceroy. When La Forette arrived on the Bosphorus, he found that Suleiman was still away with his army in Persia, but the beginning of 1536 saw the Sultan and the Grand Vizier back in the capital, and it was there, on the 18th of February, that Ibrahim signed in the Sultan's name the Ottoman Empire's first formal agreement with France. No original text of this agreement has survived in Paris or in Istanbul, so the details remain uncertain. We know, however, from other sources a fair amount about it. Perhaps its most significant feature was that it was not only a military alliance, it included also a commercial treaty, by the terms of which the subject of the Sultan and those of the French king were at full liberty to do business in each other's dominions. Frenchmen anywhere in the Ottoman Empire were answerable only to the French ambassador in Istanbul and to the French consuls in Damascus and Alexandria. This was the origin of the capitulations which allowed France to retain, for several centuries, her political and religious privileges in the Levant. The agreement shifted the whole balance of power in the Mediterranean. Western Europe was nearer to the east than ever before, and Turkey was now effectively a member of the Concert of Powers in Europe. The signing of the treaty was the last important act of the life of Ibrahim Pasha. On the morning of the 15th of March, his dead body was found in the huge palace that he had built for himself on the northwest side of the old Byzantine Hippodrome. He had clearly fought hard against the mutes who had been sent to garrot him. 3 years later, the bloodstains were still visible on the walls. His corpse was taken to a dervish monastery behind the arsenal and buried without any inscription or memorial. His name is now chiefly remembered because his old palace on the Hippodrome still bears his name. It is now the home of the Turkish and Islamic Arts Museum. The motive for his assassination was never officially established, but there was little doubt in palace circles that it was, at least indirectly, the work of Roxolana, who had always detested him. While he was alive, she was never able entirely to dominate her husband. Besides, she wanted Ibrahim's post for her son-in-law, Rustem Pasha, husband of her daughter, Miramar, and what Roxolana wanted, she almost invariably got. Despite the birth of Elizabeth, the marriage of Henry and Anne was doomed almost before it began. The fault was mostly Anne's. She was rude, irritable, and possessed of a violent temper. Nobody liked her. By the time of her marriage, not even the king. Already as early as the midsummer of 1534, he had started a serious flirtation with Jane Seymour, one of Anne's maids of honour. Anne now began to feel the bitter jealousy which, thanks to her, had for so long filled the heart of Catherine of Aragon. It was her great misfortune that she utterly lacked the mental and spiritual resources that had enabled Catherine to endure her sufferings. The result was a series of tempestuous rows with her husband, each of which, had she but known it, hammered another nail into her coffin. For Henry the situation soon became intolerable. By 1535, he was keeping his contacts with his wife to the absolute minimum, on their increasingly rare meetings barely addressing to her a civil word. He would probably still have forgiven her everything if she had only borne him a son, but there followed only the all too familiar succession of false pregnancies and stillbirths. In his heart, he probably still saw his inability to engender a male heir as God's punishment for his marriage, even though it had now finally been annulled, to Catherine. And his continued failure with Anne strongly suggested that he had not yet been forgiven. But reflections of this kind could not save his unfortunate wife. If she could not deliver what he wanted, he must find someone who could. For Anne, the writing was on the wall. While Catherine lived, she had been safe. Her death would have involved Henry in too many complications. But Catherine was dead, and her death sealed the fate of Anne. On the 24th of April, 1536, Henry set up a commission under the chairmanship of Thomas Cromwell and the Duke of Norfolk to find suitable grounds for divorce. Its work was soon done. There were none of the difficulties that had beset the king's separation from Catherine. In less than a week, Anne had been charged with adultery with several members of the court, and once each of these men had been found guilty of treason, The king had all the evidence, true or false, that he required. On the 2nd of May he sent his wife to the Tower of London, charged not only with adultery, but with incest and witchcraft, there to be tried before a jury of her peers, which included her uncle Thomas Howard and Henry Percy, son of the Earl of Northumberland, to whom, at the age of 22, she had been secretly betrothed. The verdict was, of course, a foregone conclusion. A special swordsman was brought over from Calais, the normal executioner's axe was considered too crude, and on the morning of Friday, 19th of May, 1536, the Queen of England was beheaded in an open courtyard of the Tower. Whether or not Anne had committed adultery with any or all of the half-dozen men now accused, they included George Boleyn, her own brother, we shall never know for certain. It seems unlikely, though doubtless anything was better than sex with Henry. She had certainly flirted with Mark Smeaton, one of the court musicians, with the groom of the stool, Sir Henry Norris, or Norris, and quite possibly with Sir Francis Weston, a gentleman of the Privy Chamber, and it may well be that she slept with one or more of them simply in the hopes of having the son that she felt she could no longer expect from her husband. But the risks would have been great, and there was another consideration. In the Tudor court, the Queen was never alone. How could these clandestine meetings, if they ever occurred, possibly have been arranged? It is worth recording, too, that all the accused categorically denied any misconduct, with the single exception of Smeaton, who finally made a confession only after Cromwell had threatened him with torture. With Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn both dead, was there any good reason why Henry should not now return to the Roman Catholic fold? The Pope was certainly ready to welcome him back, allowing him the same degree of authority in his lands as Charles and Francis enjoyed in theirs. But Henry had long passed the point of no return. He would have liked to have had the threat of excommunication lifted, but Protestantism was rapidly gaining ground in Germany, and he preferred to keep his options open. Besides, he had already embarked upon the project that was to occupy him and Thomas Cromwell over the next 5 years, the dissolution of all the monasteries, priories, convents, and friaries in England, and the confiscation of their assets. From the cultural point of view, the resultant loss was appalling, especially where the libraries were concerned. Of the 646 books possessed by the Abbey of the Augustinian Friars at York at the time of the dissolution, only 3 have survived. On the other hand, it must be admitted that there were far too many religious houses, altogether nearly 9,000, and that the monks enjoyed far too much of the church's wealth for the good of the country, or indeed of themselves. Less than 3 months after Anne's execution, on the 10th of August, 1536, Francis's eldest son and namesake, the Dauphin, then 18, called for a cooling drink after a strenuous game of jeu de pomme, an early form of tennis. One of his equerries, the Italian Count Sebastiano Montecuculi, obliged with a glass of iced water. The Dauphin drank it, and promptly collapsed, dying a few days later. Foul play was inevitably suspected, and Montecuculi was first put to the torture and then, with extreme brutality, executed. This did not, however, prevent the French government from also accusing the Emperor and the Governor of Milan, both of whom angrily denied the charges, accusing in their turn the dead man's brother Henry, now himself the Dauphin, and his wife, Catherine de' Medici. In fact, there is no reason to believe that the young prince's death was due to anything but perfectly natural causes. He had never entirely recovered from the tuberculosis he had contracted while imprisoned in Spain, but its consequences provide a good illustration of the state of Franco-imperial relations, which they did little to improve. Meanwhile, in the ports and harbours, as well as on the high seas of the Mediterranean, both Christian and Muslim fleets were busy. In Istanbul, Suleiman took personal charge of an immense shipbuilding program, visiting the arsenal and the cannon foundries twice a day, noted La Forette, to hasten and encourage the work. In 1536, while a Turkish naval squadron wintered in the harbour of Marseille, an imperial fleet under Andrea Doria captured 10 Turkish merchantmen off Messina, following up its victory with an intrepid raid on a squadron of the Ottoman fleet off the island of Paxos. The Sultan, determined that these 2 insults should be properly avenged, left Istanbul on the 17th of May, 1537, for Valona on the Albanian coast, the closest Ottoman port to Italy. With him he took La Forette, showing clearly enough that he saw this as a joint operation with France. The ambassador was much impressed by what he saw. I went to the camp of the Grand Signor, he wrote. As he arrived in his pavilion, built like a huge castle, and beautifully enriched with hangings, embroidery, and rich cloths in figured gold. And afterwards he led me to a high place, where he could show me the great expanse of the country, covered by the marvellous and infinite number of their pavilions. Suleiman's strategy was simple enough. It was to join Francis in a pincer movement across Italy. He would first capture the vital port of Brindisi, and would then work his way up and across the peninsula to Naples and Rome. Francis had meanwhile promised to invade from the north. His chief targets would be Genoa and Milan. Unfortunately for the Sultan, however, at the last moment the king, not uncharacteristically, changed his mind. Ignoring the plans he had agreed with Suleiman, he headed north instead of south, for Picardy and Flanders. By the time the Ottoman fleet reached Valona, the French navy was still riding at anchor in the harbour of Marseille, totally unprepared for any sort of action. With both his army and his navy already in the Adriatic, a furious Suleiman had to decide quickly on an alternative. While he was deliberating, Barbarossa staged a series of lightning raids along the coast of Apulia, returning, with the usual shiploads of treasure and slaves, to learn that his master had decided to attack the island of Corfu. The largest of the Ionian islands, Corfu had been a Venetian colony for well over 300 years, since the Fourth Crusade. To the Sultan, with his enormous army, it must have seemed an easy prey. He landed some 25,000 men and all his ordnance, some 30 cannon, including a gigantic 50-pounder, the largest in the world at the time. It was not a great success. In 5 days it fired 19 cannonballs, but only 5 of them had any effect. The rest flew straight over the town and splashed into the sea. Surrounded the chief citadel of the town and began bombarding it into submission. But Corfu's defences were strong. The town, halfway up the east coast of the island, lay behind and below the high citadel, crowning the rocky peninsula that juts out towards the shores of Albania, commanding the approaches from both land and sea. Within this citadel was a garrison of some 2,000 Italians and roughly the same number of Corfuites, together with the crews of such Venetian vessels as happened to be in port at the time. Food and ammunition were in plentiful supply. Morale was excellent. It needed to be, for the defenders were faced not just with an attack from the sea, but with a combined naval and military operation carefully, if hurriedly, planned and on a considerable scale. The devastation suffered by the local peasantry, as well as by the ordinary citizens, was appalling. But the citadel, despite constant battering from Turkish cannon and several attempts to take it by storm, somehow stood firm. Then, mercifully, came the rain. Corfu has always been famous for the ferocity of its storms, and those which burst upon it in the early days of September 1537 seemed to have been exceptional even by local standards. The cannon became immovable in the mud. Dysentery and malaria spread through the Turkish camp. After barely 3 weeks' siege, the Ottoman army re-embarked on the 15th, leaving a triumphant, if still somewhat incredulous, garrison to celebrate its victory. But the war was not over. Barbarossa's fleet was still active, and the other Mediterranean harbours and islands that remained in Venetian hands were not as well defended as Corfu. One by one they fell. Nauplia, Malvasia, now Monemvasia, on the east coast of the Peloponnese, then the islands, Scyros, Aegina, Ios, Patmos, Astypalaia, all of them considerably nearer to the Turkish mainland than to Venice, whose fleet was now blocked by the throng of Ottoman ships in the Adriatic Narrows. With some 25 of its islands devastated and thousands of young Christians carried off into slavery, the most serene republic had been brought to its knees. And it was Kheir ed-Din Barbarossa who was responsible for its humiliation. No wonder that when he returned to Istanbul, it was to a hero's welcome such had never been known, and the old pirate gave as good as he got. 400,000 gold pieces, 1,000 young women, and 1,500 youths. There was also a personal present for the Sultan. 400 more youths, dressed in scarlet and carrying vessels of gold and silver, bales of precious silks and embroidered purses overflowing with gold coins. The victory of Corfu had already gone sour. Every week was now bringing reports of new defeats, new losses. The Sultan was again on the offensive, and the Christian princes, for all their plans and promises, seemed incapable of forming alliances that existed otherwise than on paper, or that were not poisoned by mutual suspicions and petty bickering before they even took shape. In the summer of 1538, one such attempt, embarked upon by Venice, the Pope and the Emperor, with all the fervour of a crusade, and a degree of wild optimism such that the participants actually made advanced plans for the division of the Ottoman Empire between them, ended not as they had imagined, with the capture of Constantinople, but with a further miserable defeat off Preveza, a Turkish stronghold on the coast of Epirus, opposite the spot where the Battle of Actium had been fought 1,569 years before. It was here that Andrea Doria, reluctantly persuaded to return to the theatre of war, delayed and prevaricated until the battle was as good as lost. He had some 160 ships, Barbarossa 22. The result should have been a walkover, but after a few initial exchanges, Doria simply refused to fight. He was neither a coward nor a fool, and treachery or deliberate malice is surely improbable. Perhaps the most likely explanation is that he had received secret orders from his emperor, who saw the Barbary corsair as a more immediate threat and was anxious to preserve his fleet intact. In any event, Doria was indirectly responsible for the 7 Venetian galleys that were sunk. The Turks, by contrast, sustained no damage of any kind. It was by now clear that Venice must negotiate a peace with the Sultan on whatever terms she could. Of all her recent losses, those which crippled her most were Nauplia and Monemvasia, her last trading posts in the Peloponnese, and her ambassador, Tommaso Contarini, was authorized to offer a stiff ransom, 150,000 ducats in the first instance, rising to 300,000 should the Sultan prove particularly intractable. This last sum was by any standards enormous, and it was thought that Suleiman, who had new preoccupations in the East and was known to be not averse to the idea of at least a truce in Western waters, would be only too happy to accept it. Alas, he proved to be nothing of the kind, and Venice found herself obliged to agree to a treaty on terms far harsher than she had ever contemplated. The 300,000 ducats that she had offered were exacted from her as general reparations. There was to be no question of the return of the 2 Peloponnesian ports, or indeed of any of the other territories lost to her in the past 3 years. In future, too, Venetian ships might no longer enter or leave Turkish ports without permission. There were also several minor items that seemed calculated to cause the maximum of inconvenience and humiliation, but Venice had no choice but to accept, and she knew it. The spring of 1538 saw Charles and Francis still at daggers drawn. In March, Francis had invaded Italy and advanced as far as Rivoli in Piedmont before Pope Paul managed to arrange a truce, but his heart had not really been in it. The fact was that the Provençal campaign had exhausted both rulers. Neither was in any condition to continue serious fighting for the present. But they remained bitterly divided on any number of issues, of which the most pressing was, as always, Milan. Charles was now willing to invest the king's 3rd and youngest son, Charles, Duke of Orléans, with the duchy, but only after Francis had joined him in a crusade against the Turk. Francis claimed that he was quite prepared to go on the crusade, but only after Orléans had been invested with Milan. At length they both accepted an invitation to attend a meeting to be held under papal auspices at Nice in May and June 1538. While there, the two never met. Each negotiated separately with the Pope. Somehow, however, they managed to agree on a 10-year truce which they signed on the 18th of June. Their careful avoidance of each other seemed mildly ridiculous, but their mutual relations greatly improved shortly thereafter, when in July, as the Emperor was on his way back to Spain, the two met at Aiguemorte. Ostensibly, their purpose was to discuss the projected crusade against the Turks and the stamping out of Protestant heresies. Francis, who had no intention of going to war with his friend the Sultan, is reported as having spent most of the time making long and noisy protestations of eternal friendship. Charles, we may imagine, was more inclined to hold his peace. But for some time after this, the two brothers-in-law remained surprisingly friendly. They became friendlier still in the following year, after the death of the Empress Isabella on the 1st of May, 1539. To Charles it came as a crushing blow. Despite his frequent, though necessary, absences from Spain, he had loved his wife to distraction, and he now made no secret of his sorrow. It was perhaps as a gesture of sympathy as much as anything else that, when a rebellion broke out in Ghent that autumn, Francis invited him to travel from Spain to the Low Countries by land through France. Charles gratefully accepted, keeping Christmas with the king at Fontainebleau and paying his first and only visit to Paris, which, on New Year's Day, 1540, the two of them entered together. Throughout the emperor's two-month stay, we are told, Francis could not have been more friendly and considerate. Though some felt that his gentle pressure on the recent widower to marry his own daughter Margaret was perhaps a trifle premature. As for Charles, rumour had it that he had even offered Francis the imperial crown of Byzantium, once Suleiman had been eliminated after their joint crusade. All this, as may be imagined, caused considerable problems to Antonio Rincon, the portly Spaniard who had succeeded La Forette as Francis's ambassador to the port, and whose duty it was to keep the Sultan happy at all costs. Astonishingly, he managed to do so, assuring Suleiman that his master had signed the Peace of Cambrai, by which France and the Empire were effectively reconciled, only to secure the release of his children. In September 1539, the Sultan even invited Francis to Istanbul to celebrate his son's circumcision, and soon enough, after relations between Charles and Francis had returned to their normal level of hostility, Rincon returned to Paris with concrete proposals for a joint attack by King and Sultan on the Emperor. Before doing so, he proudly reported he had been accorded an exceptionally long audience with Suleiman, lasting for 2 hours or more, an honour which he had granted to no one else, either Christian or of his own religion. Alas, poor Rincon was never again to see the Bosphorus. In the early summer of 1541 he set off from Paris on his way back to Istanbul, but while sailing down the river Po with a companion he was set upon and killed by a party of men in the service of the Marquis del Vasto, who was then governing Milan in the Emperor's name. Not till September was the truth discovered, when the French ambassador in Venice tracked down one of the watermen who had been forced to transport the murderers and, later, to help carry the corpses ashore. This flagrant violation of the conventions of diplomacy caused a storm of protest, not only among the subjects of Francis and Suleiman, both of whom held the emperor personally responsible, but even in the imperial territories. Pope Paul condemned it in the harshest terms, while the Sultan spoke grimly of impalement. As soon as King Henry heard the news of his wife's execution, he summoned his barge and went straight to Jane Seymour. Next day the two were betrothed, and on the 30th of May, 1536, just 11 days after Anne's death, he married Jane in the Palace of Whitehall. The new queen, who had been a lady-in-waiting to both her predecessors, was nowhere near as highly educated as Catherine, or even as Anne. She could probably read and write a bit, but by far her greatest skill, we are told, was with her needle. Her embroidery was reported to be a wonder to behold. What most recommended her, however, was her character. Sir John Russell, who was later to serve Henry as his Lord High Admiral, described her as being as gentle a lady as ever I knew. In this respect, she must certainly have been a welcome contrast to her predecessor. It soon became clear, on the other hand, that life under Jane was going to be a lot less fun than it had been under Anne. The extravagant entertainments and banquets that had been such a feature of life during the previous regime were replaced by shorter, simpler meals, and it was not long before the new queen had formally banned the elaborate French fashions that Anne had introduced. There must have been many at court who soon found themselves dreaming fondly of the bad old days. In her dealings with her increasingly difficult husband, however, Jane could boast one important success. It concerned her stepdaughter, Princess Mary. Mary's recent life had been little short of a nightmare. For over 3 years she never once saw her father. She was, first of all, held to be illegitimate, with all the shame that such a condition entailed. Thus she was invariably obliged to give precedence to her 3-year-old half-sister, and was even prevented from showing herself in public, lest she should be acclaimed or cheered, for despite all Henry's efforts, the people as a whole remained determinedly loyal to her mother and herself. Constantly shunted from one great house to another, she was barred from the only place where she wished to be, at her mother's side. Why, one wonders, why did Henry so adamantly refuse the entreaties of his former wife and daughter to be allowed to see each other, even when Catherine lay on her deathbed? It has been suggested that he was simply afraid, afraid of the secret links that he always believed them to maintain with the Emperor, who was nephew to the one and first cousin to the other, and through him to the Pope. Perhaps he was, though we may be sure that Anne Boleyn had worked on his fears and exaggerated them. As the mother of Elizabeth, she had, after all, every reason to see that Mary was kept at arm's length. But Anne and Catherine were now both in their graves. The situation had changed. And Jane it was who first herself befriended Mary, and then, thanks to her own gentleness and sweetness of character, managed finally to bring the sad princess back into relative favour. She failed to restore her to the succession, as she had hoped. That was to be the work of Henry's sixth and last wife, Catherine Parr. But she did at least ensure that relatively cordial relations between father and daughter were eventually re-established. With Jane Seymour, the first of his wives who caused him no trouble, Henry was probably as happy as he had ever been. But away in the north, serious trouble was brewing. It had many causes. The breach with Rome, the incipient attack on the monasteries and abbeys, the king's ignoble treatment of his previous two wives and two daughters, the insecurity of the succession, the continual executions, all these played their part, and in October 1536 the dissatisfaction burst out into open rebellion. It began in Lincolnshire, but it was only when it spread to Yorkshire that it assumed serious proportions and became known as the Pilgrimage of Grace. It was headed by a barrister named Robert Aske, who led a body of some 9,000 followers to York and occupied the city. Within a week or two their number had increased to about 40,000, and it was now that Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk, and George Talbot, Earl of Shrewsbury, opened negotiations with the rebels. Norfolk promised, in the name of the king, a general pardon and a parliament to be held at York within a year, as well as a reprieve for the religious houses until after the parliament had met. He had, in fact, no authority to make any promises of this kind, although the mood of the pilgrims was such that, had he not done so, he and Shrewsbury might not have escaped alive. Aske dismissed his men, a decision that he was later to regret, and then travelled to London, where he had an audience with the king. Henry received him with every courtesy and made him further promises, including safe conduct back to Yorkshire. But just as he was beginning his journey back to the north, fighting broke out again. It was all Henry needed to make him change his mind. He immediately had Aske arrested and taken to the Tower. He was charged and convicted of high treason at Westminster, and was then sent back to York, where, on a special scaffold erected at Clifford's Tower, which still stands, he was hanged in chains. And that was only the beginning of the king's revenge. Over the next 2 years, a total of 216 were executed, some hanged, drawn, and quartered, others beheaded or burned at the stake. It was while these executions were at their height, sometime during the early spring of 1537, that Jane Seymour murmured to her husband that she was pregnant. She developed a craving for quails, which Henry, in his excitement, ordered in vast quantities from Flanders. During the following summer, she cancelled all engagements and remained in the care of the best doctors and most experienced midwives that could be found in the kingdom. And finally, at 2 o'clock in the morning of Friday, the 12th of October, at the Palace of Hampton Court, she gave birth by caesarean section to the king's only legitimate male child. The father was not present, he had hurried off to Esher to escape the plague, but the good news quickly brought him back to London, where he ordered a whole series of celebrations and ceremonial banquets. 3 days later the baby was baptized with the name of Edward. This time it was his mother who was absent. Baptisms in Tudor times, for obvious reasons, tended to follow very shortly after births, and mothers were normally excused them. But there was another reason, too. She was far from well. Why, we shall never know. Most likely it was a puerperal fever due to some bacterial infection. Whatever the reason, Jane died on the 24th, less than a fortnight after the birth of her child. Her husband mourned her, but not excessively. He now had a son. That was the important thing. He wore black for the required 3 months, but long before even this short period had expired, he was actively seeking a new wife. His first choice had been the 16-year-old Christina, daughter of the deposed Christian II of Denmark and the Emperor's niece. King Christian had married Charles's sister Isabella. At 13 she had married the Duke of Milan, but had been widowed within a year. Alas, the girl herself was far from enthusiastic about the match. For her council suspecteth, that her great-aunt was poisoned, that the second was put to death, and the third lost for lack of keeping her childbed. Unsurprisingly, she had no desire to be wife number four. Henry now turned his attention to France. There were no fewer than five suitable French princesses in whom he was interested, and he now proposed that all five should be gathered at Calais, so that he could make his choice. But at this point it was made clear to him that he had gone too far. Francis replied icily that in France it was not the custom to send noble ladies to be paraded in review, as at a horse sale. He would agree to any one of the girls being sent to Calais, but no more. It was not only his renewed hopes of matrimony that caused the king concern. He was becoming increasingly anxious over the behaviour of his fellow monarchs. He had been informed of the 10-year truce of Nice, and also at the meeting of Charles and Francis at Aiguemort. In recent years he had been sincerely thankful that, thanks to his difficulties with the Reformation and his campaign in North Africa, the Emperor had been too busy to launch a Catholic crusade against him, as he might very well have done. But it could still happen. At Aiguemort, he and Francis had signed a treaty in which Henry, King of England, had been completely ignored, and a new serious danger was now looming from Paul III himself. Henry's continued despoliation of the monasteries, his open negotiations with the Lutherans, and his destruction of sacred shrines, including that of St. Thomas Becket at Canterbury, had convinced the Pope that he could no longer be tolerated as king and must be removed. On the 17th of December 1538, he signed a bull, by which Henry was not only excommunicated, but formally deposed, his subjects absolved from all obedience. 10 days later, he secretly sent the English Cardinal, Reginald Pole, to rally the Catholic powers and to persuade them to take the necessary action. The first step would be to break off diplomatic relations and impose a trade embargo, and it was clearly envisaged that an armed invasion of England would follow. Less than a month later, Charles and Francis concluded yet another pact, this time at Toledo, in which each promised not to enter any agreement with Henry without the other's consent, while various further marriages were planned between the houses of Habsburg and Valois. Some years before, Henry had shouted at the papal nuncio that he cared not a fig for excommunications, which was probably true at the time. Nevertheless, by early 1539, he was in a state of near panic. Rumours were rife. There was talk of imminent invasion, of fleets gathering in Antwerp and Boulogne. The English defences were reinforced not only along the south and east coasts, but also along the Scottish border, since the Scots too were in a threatening mood. The king himself was galvanised into action, inspecting palisades and ramparts, bulwarks and barricades, and blockhouses, visiting ships in London and Portsmouth, reviewing troops in half a dozen different counties. He was right to be worried. Were the invasions that he feared actually to take place, and were revolutions simultaneously to break out at home as it had in 1536, his position would have been serious indeed. He was saved by the situation in Germany, where the ideas of the Reformation were spreading like wildfire across the whole of the north. Protestant princes had taken over in Saxony and Brandenburg, only Brunswick still held out. Charles, whose dreams of a crusade against Suleiman were now retreating further and further into the distance, had more than enough on his plate without getting involved with Henry, and when Cardinal Pole arrived at Toledo, he told him so in no uncertain terms. Pole was so disappointed by his reception that he decided against his projected visit to Francis, retiring instead to the papal city of Carpentras to await further instructions from his master. It was, as it turned out, a wise decision. Francis showed himself no keener to receive him than Charles had been. He made it perfectly clear that he had no intention of breaking with England just to please the Pope, or of taking any action against its king without the agreement of the Emperor. In May, to Henry's surprise and considerable relief, a French ambassador arrived in London and assured him that his master had no hostile intentions. The panic was over, and the king's mind returned to the question of marriage. Jane Seymour had been 18 months in her grave. He himself was 48, not getting any younger, but now putting on weight with alarming speed. His infant son was weak and sickly, and he urgently needed another. He was also anxious to ally himself with the Protestant princes of Germany.